step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Hope for the best.
Expect the worst. Some preacher pain, some dire thirst.
Welcome to the Commentary Magazine Daily Podcast. Today is Tuesday, April 11th, 2023. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine. We are closing our May issue today, I think, owing to the final 2 days of the Passover holiday. We may not have the issue up for you online maybe until Friday, but maybe earlier. I'm not quite clear yet. Abe is tilting his head back and forth in comparable confusion, but we have a dazzling piece. I'm now pitching to you the dazzling cover piece, which is called The Return of Paganism by Liel Leibovitz, and it is a small masterpiece. So please look for that. And I have mentioned his name, so I will now formally introduce executive editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Media commentary columnist and American Enterprise Institute fellow Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
Matt Continetti is out today in a fan favorite guest, Mark Halperin, author of the Wide World of News newsletter, which you can subscribe to if you go to markhalperin.substack.com. Hi, Mark.
I'm no Continetti, but I'm happy to be here.
Well, that's no one is.
That's true.
No one is. No, he's irreplaceable. And yet here you are replacing him at least for the day. And your 7-day-a-week newsletter, The Wide World of News, a must read for everybody who pays attention to politics and America and everything else that is important in the world. I just want to throw out to people your first item today, which is that the new leaked U.S. national security documents keep being exposed to fresh and damaging exclusives, one from the Associated Press. U.S. spies caught Russian intelligence officers boasting that they had convinced the oil-rich United Arab Emirates to work together against U.S. and U.K. intelligence agencies, the Associated Press reports. And the Washington Post reports their big story today that President Sisi of Egypt recently ordered subordinates to produce up to 40,000 rockets to be covertly shipped to Russia. So, Mark, the scope and extent of this intelligence dump onto social media, which apparently started in February and is so far sourceless, and it's very unclear who benefits from it and whether it's some kind of nihilistic just sort of bleat of someone's, or whether, you know, this is a purposeful leak by intelligence agencies. What do you make of the political impact of it and the, let's say, technical impact on the government of the United States going forward?
I'd say it's dangerous and delightful. Delightful because it's really interesting. As it's been pointed out, these are leaks of documents that are almost in real time, unlike some of the previous big leaks we've seen where the documents were very old in most cases. And it's dangerous because it really does undermine not just America's relationships with some of our allies and endangers the prospects of the war in Ukraine, of Zelensky winning, but America's human assets, particularly in Russia, could really be imperiled by this. David Ignatius of the Washington Post, who's very plugged in on intelligence matters, says some people think the Ukrainians are leaking these and some people think the Russians are leaking these, which shows you, which goes to the point you raised, which is that the motives of these various, of putting out these various documents seems almost, it seems very unclear, and the effect of it is, runs across purposes. So it's a lot of mystery here about who did it, but there's no doubt that the U.S. is acknowledging that they're real for the most part, and that it's doing a lot of damage, some visible, but some behind the scenes in a way that is really problematic for the Biden administration.
Some of the documents had been doctored, though, right? We do have some evidence, right? Weren't some of them acknowledged as having been doctored, perhaps the ones the Russians released?
I think there's one that has a doctoring effect.
But I find it strange that American officials, including Kirby from the podium, are acknowledging for the most part that they're real. I don't know. They wouldn't admit the Hunter Biden laptop was real, but they're basically embracing these as truthful, which seems unusual. Normally they would just say, you know, we don't know what these are and no one should believe everything they read.
Well, and coming on the heels of something we didn't get to talk about because we were off for Passover, the Afghanistan report that was issued by the Biden administration that basically said none of this is our fault. It was really all Trump's fault. I mean, this is strike two in their, you know, foreign policy was Biden's strong suit, supposedly, going into the next election. So this is another blow to the idea that his administration has competence at the fore of its foreign policy work.
I find it dangerous and depressing. Not dangerous and delightful, I think, precisely because of what Christine is talking about. Because, you know, I mean, among the really upsetting things that the documents reveal is our sort of inability to project power among allies. And it also comes right after you have Macron's meeting with Xi, and you have Macron giving an interview to Politico talking about how it would be a mistake to stick with the Americans on this and to get drawn into their fight with China. We are in a sort of lonely, dangerous place right now in terms of foreign policy as a country. And that is I find the sort of the most alarming thing happening at the moment.
I don't know.
To be clear, I said delightful only tongue in cheek because it's really interesting. Just interesting.
There is very interesting stuff, including the revelation that the Mossad is involved in the protests in Israel, thus literally kind of revealing a deep state motivation and backstage aid for a revolt against the victorious government that came into power in early January. It's not delightful, but it is an interesting bit of intelligence. And of course, much of what we understand about how government works in the complexities of America's geostrategic role over in historical terms comes from document dumps and releases and revelations like this. A lot of us, I mean, I was only 11 or 12 at the time, but the Pentagon Papers, which the revelation of which was, you know, a massive scandal and I think the single biggest intelligence breach, domestic intelligence breach up to that moment in American history, of course, has been that those documents have been crucial in helping us understand what went on in the Vietnam War. And while their release at the time was opposed by people who were as afraid of it as Abe is afraid of this one, and I think, as Mark, you said, like, these were actually historical documents, even when they were released, the Pentagon Papers. They were an attempt to analyze critically what had happened in Vietnam on the part of policymakers in the U.S. government. We rely on some of these kinds of leaks over time to give us the perspective on what was going on that we lack, and they often reveal not nefarious behavior by the U.S. government, but sometimes naive behavior, or you get a sense of how few choices policymakers actually had and how they were often compelled to do things because the circumstances, you know, they had a choice between a bad option and a worse option, and they took the bad option rather than the worst option. Over time, these things have less effect. But obviously, South Korea believes that this is incredibly injurious to its governments, the documents involving South Korea, which they continue to claim, as opposed to our government, that they are fabricated and manufactured. The revelation that in the Middle East, for example, that people are playing both ends against the middle, right? That our ally Egypt is selling rockets to Russia, wants to sell rockets to Russia, obviously commercially, because they could use the money. And that, of course, is at cross purposes with our policies in Ukraine, and that the UAE may be playing footsie with the Russians as well. It's worth remembering that this is a entirely transactional part of the world, and that the question you want to ask yourself is, what is it about the Biden administration's policies and behavior? And Jonathan Schanzer's written about this for Commentary a couple of times since Biden came into office. What is it that is keeping, that is making some of these U.S. allies hedge their bets or try to make money fighting the United States's goals in an area, in a part of the world that they don't really care that much about? That's a very big thing. Biden's inability to establish American authority in the Middle East such that people like the UAE and Sisi are not afraid of doing things that go run across purposes to the United States. That's a little unnerving.
I mean, the UAE is largely allied with Saudi Arabia. They have squabbles all the time, but they're very close. And Biden has misplayed the U.S.-Saudi policy since he got into office, getting on their bad side, never letting go of the Khashoggi issue. So I'm not surprised. It just goes to show how the cascade of bad effects that a wrong decision can make.
But I think that there's also a trifecta effect. You mentioned the Afghanistan report, which I guess they had to release, and which they attempted very incompetently to deflect blame. So I guess they gave some people a talking point about how, you know, Trump, in its failure to involve the Afghan government in the negotiations with the Taliban, had hastened the collapse of the Afghan government, which is absolutely preposterous. They themselves thought, their intelligence said, that the Afghan government would stand up for months at the very least after we pulled out. So how you can blame Trump for that, I don't really understand. But that comes, of course, after the Chinese balloon, which we now have these updated reports that suggest that China actually scored an intelligence coup with the balloon, since we didn't shoot it down. It got all kinds of information as it was traveling from the Pacific Northwest across to the Carolina coast. And this breach, Afghanistan report, Chinese balloon, man, oh man, there is, if the Republican Party was able to talk at all coherently about foreign policy, it would have this is setting the table for a field day about how these people cannot be trusted with America's security.
And what you see in these documents is a suggestion that the administration's calibration help Ukraine, but not so much that you get into a world war with Russia, has been off. These documents make about the strongest case anyone has done that says, in too many cases, the administration has erred on the side of not helping Ukraine enough. And that vulnerability is one the administration has worked very hard to stave off, but May has put in very sharp relief here. And you're hearing that not just from Republican critics, but some Democrats already privately saying, you know, it's going to be hard to make the case in the face of these documents that everything to help the Ukrainians that could have been done was done.
Look, Abe, this gets to, you know, part of the incredible frustration that we feel and that others feel about the way Trump and the MAGA people are blocking out the sun when it comes to foreign policy or confusing things. Oh, we shouldn't be doing Ukraine. We should only be focusing on China. What, all that stuff. Because what Mark says is absolutely true. And I see absolutely no political pressure on the Biden administration to treat the Ukrainian arms situation with the urgency that is required or that is suggested by these reports, because there's no counter pressure from the other side.
The counter pressure.
Biden, if there's a hawk in American politics on Ukraine, it's Biden, right, relatively speaking. And so he's as far to the right as you're going to get as a policymaker. And it's not enough. Yet, no one's putting pressure on him to do more, except Robert Menendez or so. I mean, I don't know. Go ahead. Sorry.
The only pressure is this nonsense is goes in the other direction. Is this nonsense about a blank check? You know, stop furnishing Zelensky with a blank check. And that's coming from the right. Another interesting thing about the leak is that it reveals this secret aid, military aid that South Korea was giving to Ukraine, planning to give to Ukraine, which also goes to show that the idea that our fight with China is wholly separate from what's happening in Ukraine with Russia is false. I mean, you know, obviously, if South Korea is interested in this outcome, there's good reason for it. Another weakness here that a coherent Republican Party that was coherent on foreign policy could bring up is the fact of the leak itself. This is another, you know, this is a security disaster, and my guess is we're not going to get sufficient answers about it because that's the way things have been going. Gravely serious. I doubt we'll, as serious as it is, I doubt we will find out who and how this happened.
Right after the Supreme Court leaker is found.
Right.
They get to this. Right. Look, this is a hypothetical now, but it's not a far-fetched one with huge implications for the 2024 presidential race and geopolitics. What if Putin wins? These papers suggest Putin might win, that the U.S. government thinks Putin might win. What does Joe Biden say to the American people if Putin wins?
He would have to be held to account for Putin winning. Now, Trump has the line on this. It's a ridiculous line, but it is his line. His line is, Putin would never have gone into Ukraine if I were president. Now, it's ridiculous because Trump also would have pulled out of Afghanistan in 2021 had he been reelected. And it was the pullout from Afghanistan. Maybe you could say it was the pullout that was incompetent, but it was the pullout from Afghanistan that gave Putin the green light. That was Trump's policy that Biden was only following through on. And I don't think that he can legitimately claim that he would somehow, just his mere presence there, would have prevented Putin from aiding. But I don't think that's true. But it's might be an effective line of attack. Saying, look, you know, people were afraid of America when I was president. They thought I was going to blow the world up. You know what? That's not a bad strategy sometimes when the world is chaotic, is to make people think that they don't know how you're going to react. And I left, and then this, you know, doddering old fool came in and screwed everything up, and no one's afraid of America anymore. And look what happened. So that could be very bad for him.
You might think Talk Loudly and Carry a Tray of Big Macs is not an effective message on foreign policy, but it worked for him the first time. Certainly with a lot of American voters, that notion of Trump is a strong guy who deters aggressive behavior. You may not credit it substantively, but it worked for him in 16.
Well, there was a CNN poll over the weekend looking at advantages that Republicans have over Democrats on certain issues. And the Republican advantage on, I think it was phrased as world affairs, not foreign policy, was just 2 points, which is low. I mean, the Republicans, because of the infighting and the sort of difficulty on the nationalist right, their unwillingness to embrace a role for America and the rest of the world, and their very insularity and isolationism, that is poised to give them the same weird disadvantage that Democrats now have on education, right? That used to be a solid Democratic issue. Now it's leaning Republican. And then you have foreign policy, which used to be solidly, you know, Republican favored and is now going back to the Democrats. I do think that the Biden message last time around, that we're the grownups in the room, we're sophisticated, we understand all the complicated nuances, that sold people because they didn't want the chaos and disorder and unpredictability of a Trump administration on foreign policy with all his like love letters from dictators and whatnot. But this time around, because of all of these debacles, there's no way he can argue that. And I'm not clear what his message would be going. He just said over the weekend at the Easter egg roll, I'm planning to run again. What's his message now? I'm going to clean up my own mess. He's never going to do that. As Abe says, they would barely answer questions about, you know, the report on Afghanistan. So I'm curious, Mark, what you think his message will be. I mean, what would be a positive foreign policy message given the last few months of debacles?
Well, I think it depends on the state of play at the time he has to defend it, right? I mean, right now, you can make an argument. You can make an argument that not on Saudi, but on China, on Ukraine, on NATO, on Latin America, you can make an argument that things are moving in the right direction and better. But that may not be the case. You may not be able to make that argument. Again, if Ukraine falls, what that would do to NATO would be sort of extraordinary. And on China, they've done a good job treading water. But there's incrementally more, you know, on the military front in particular, not so much on the economic front, things are getting bad. So I'm not quite sure what he'd say, but in terms of substance, but in terms of rhetoric, what he'd say is Donald Trump is worse.
Okay. You know, Trump's the nominee. Christine mentioned the CNN poll over the weekend, and it is really striking. There are two data points that are really striking. So Christine mentioned the margin on which party is closer to your views by issue. And if you look at this, you would think Republicans are like setting the table for a triumph in 2024. Here is the Republican advantage. On the economy, 12 points. On crime, 12 points. On immigration, 10 points. On government spending, which of course is going to be a big issue coming up in the summer when the debt ceiling crisis hits, 9 points. Republicans aren't saying that they want to push, you know, spending cuts out of nowhere. This isn't just some kind of delusional Republican craziness that they have internal polling showing what the CNN poll shows, which is that Republicans are more closer to Americans' views on government spending by 9 points. World affairs, as Christine mentioned, 3 points, parents' rights policies, 3 points, freedom of speech, 2 points. Where are Democrats better situated? Social and cultural issues, 3 points, which is interesting because, of course, parents' rights policies are social and cultural issue policies. Republicans are a 3-point advantage on that. Democrats are generally at a 3-point advantage on social and cultural issues. And abortion, 10 points. Now, if you look at that, you're like, oh my God, Democrat, like batten down the hatches, Democrats, you are in deep trouble. But Trump versus Biden, I'm not talking about the head-to-head polling. Trump is now viewed favorably after the indictment by 25% of those polled and unfavorably by close to 2/3. And Biden is at around 40. So there is now a 15-point gap. When Trump beat Hillary, they were equally unpopular, as I recall. They were both in the low 30s on popularity and in the high 50, low 60s on unpopularity. Biden is unpopular for a president, right, at 40, 41%. But if his rival is at 25%, he's going to win no matter what the issue set is. A person with a 25% approval rating is not going to win the presidency, because every person who approves of him is in a deep red state that will already go for him, and not in one of the three or five swing states that they're not going to. So Mark, do you agree with that assessment, or am I like overreading a year, you know, a year and a half before the election?
Well, I mean, I think if Trump is the Republican nominee, and today I think he's the heavy favorite to be the Republican nominee, he's one of the two most likely people to be the next president, to state the obvious. And right. And I think that if we have stagflation and Ukraine has fallen, Trump could do it again. He barely lost last time. And although he's not had the most successful ex-presidency of all time since leaving office, he's also in almost every head-to-head poll with Biden. Biden's well below 50, and Trump's even or ahead or a little bit behind. So there's no doubt that if Donald Trump was the nominee and Joe Biden was the nominee, there's no doubt in my mind Trump could win, and that he could win even if he was less popular than Biden.
Okay,
Biden is certainly reading these internal poll, whatever internal polling they're doing, they're reading this too, because they just announced that they're going to have a bunch of TikTok influencers who are going to just like basically be in-house in the White House, you know, launching all. So that's the social, cultural, and abortion stuff right there. That's the young voter. Those are the particularly the young women who the Republicans really have no chance in hell of getting unless they change their messaging a little, even a little bit. So they're clearly banking on those voters turning out in a way that they, you know, they certainly have in the past for Democratic candidates like Obama. But I found that whole influencer thing hilarious, especially given the advanced age of our current president. But they are strategizing for a run, giving him, you know, filling in those culture gaps that Trump actually will bring his numbers down, because every time he opens his mouth about culture war issues, he's only speaking preaching to the choir.
That I think that's very smart. Actually, I also think, you know, it's absurd. TikTok influencers and social are absurd people, and it's embarrassing that they are now going to have this pride of place. But those under 30 numbers on political support are really staggering. I mean, when the youth vote went to 18. Democrats had a rude awakening, because in 1972, the youth vote went for Nixon, and they assumed, because of the lack of sophistication in polling, actually, in the late 60s, early 70s, and they assumed that young people were all were all protesting Kent State, and were not, in fact, people. Most of the people who were in Vietnam were Americans between the ages of 18 and 21 with family members at home who also supported the war effort. And so there was this bizarre blindness on that front. And wherever that was, where the youth vote pretty much was evenly split between the parties, is gone. That is now a Democratic vote by 2/3 to 3/4. And Biden, it would be political malpractice for the Biden people and the Democrats not to do everything possible in their power to get every single one of them, if possible, to the polling places, which is hard because young people tend not to vote. And with a slight degradation in the minority vote for Democrats, Blacks and Hispanics, or the slight increase in Republican voting patterns with those populations, they need to offset that, and they need to generate a vote that can put them over the top. And they have these ready-made issues in front of them: social liberalism and abortion. They didn't really have them in 2016. And they also had an old, out-of-touch lady that was running in 2016 who didn't push their buttons. But, you know,
John, it was her turn. It was her turn, John. Let's not forget.
It was, yes. Standing between, you know, them and the Handmaid's Tale, that's actually a message that resonates. We make fun of it. We tease it, but it's a message that resonates. And so politically, I think the influencers are just one aspect of an all-out. Remember, Democrats are good. They're good at elections. They're actually good at this. And so they're already in 2023 trying to prepare the ground to make an unprecedented, you know, push to get those voters out.
On this front, the Biden administration has also now revamped its Title IX guidelines to forbid colleges and universities from banning transgender athletes, males at birth, basically, from forbid colleges from banning those athletes from leagues that in which they would play with, on teams in which they would play against females. That's
right.
I think an overreach here, because that's not popular.
Right. I think that is an overreach, and this is where you get to the misunderstanding of the youth vote. Okay, which is it's not clear to me that they're all radicals. They just don't like that these people cut off access to abortion where they are. And they don't like all the fun killing and the, you know, people yelling and screaming and whatever it is. They're socially liberal. That's not to say they're socially radical. That's a classic mistake, you know, that people make, and maybe they'll push it too far. I don't know. Mark, where are you on the... Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. Well, there's a new quiet meme that I've been hearing about this week about Ron DeSantis, that he doesn't know it, but he's already dead. Dead to beat Trump, and if he somehow beat Trump, dead to win the general election. And part of that is about his lack of appeal to the youth vote. If he really signs a bill banning abortion after 6 weeks, if you look what he's doing on immigration, if you look what he's done on criminal justice, these are all issues that young voters care a lot about, that Democrats have done a very good job of catering to. And if Ron DeSantis has a theory of the case about how to beat Donald Trump and then how to beat Joe Biden, he's keeping it a closely held secret, including, again, he's a younger guy. He should be appealing to the youth vote. But those issues, criminal justice, immigration, and abortion, they matter a lot to younger voters.
No, this is such a good point, because this is actually something I like about him, is that he's kind of a young fogey. I think he was probably that guy when he was 25, just like he is when he's 45. I like that. I happen to like that, but I don't think my sons, for example, will get to vote in their first election in 2024. So I don't think that necessarily appeals to their age group. But the difference between 6 weeks and 12 weeks, that for him is that ban, that abortion ban at 6 weeks, that is huge for young women. And that is not even young women who are not, like, you know, shout my abortion t-shirt wearers, just generally the average sort of liberal leaning young woman in this country. That's a huge thing. That's all they're talking about. And there's no, I don't see the political advantage for him in pursuing that. Like,
the opposite. When people started focusing on what was interesting about Ron DeSantis after he became governor in 2018, it was that he had run as this Trumpian lunatic and then governed as a managerial conservative. And one of the things that made him appealing, and Brian Kemp, this is even after 2020, Brian Kemp of Georgia, was that they did not kowtow to the pro-life, the most extreme elements of the pro-life movement. They were 15-week abortion ban people. And they not only did they get away with it, but they prospered at the polls in 2022 in that regard, because they both won landslide victories and were not punished for it. And DeSantis, I think if DeSantis has a theory of his electoral case, it's that he's going back to 2018 and saying, I'm going to run as far to the right as I possibly can to capture, you know, a party that doesn't, you know, maybe slightly skeptical of me for whatever reason. And then I can move back to the center during the election. And you know what? You can't. We ran this play in 2012 and you can't. There is no Etch-a-Sketch. Who was the guy who said there was a communications person on the Romney team?
Romney. I think it may have been Kevin Madden, an otherwise intelligent.
It wasn't Kevin Madden. It was somebody else who then I think was disappeared.
I think it's Eric Fernstrom.
Thank you. Exactly. So he said, you know, it's like Etch-a-Sketch. You redraw yourself. June, and you know what? Sorry, that's not the way. That was a terrible thing to say, and it was a terrible policy to pursue.
There's this weird thing about DeSantis in terms of the press and donor appraisal of him. On the one hand, I don't think he gets nearly enough credit and explanation for how did he turn Florida into such a red state? Like, what is it? Because he's not just getting hard right voters in order to win that victory that he won. On the other hand, just signing this abortion bill, which it looks like he's going to do, I think there's not enough attention being given to how politically suicidal that is. People say it's unpopular. It could literally cost him any chance of being president. It's so unpopular. It's so unpopular.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's been a lot of tea leaf reading, and you've been one of the people who's been trying to read the DeSantis tea leaves. It's very hard to penetrate his inner circle and understand who's doing what and who's saying what. My general theory has been, as people know from listening to this, that his people have become some weird amalgam of Joaquin Castro and Kristen Gillibrand in 2019 and are living online, and they are getting this mad rush of affection and attention, or what they feel is affection, from owning the libs and saying the most extreme things that they can say. And aside from the fact that and that's terrible, that is a terrible way to present yourself to an electorate eventually that will be 160 million people now. 155 million people voted in 2020. It's likely 160 million or more will vote in 2024. Trying to appeal to 2.5 million of them online is bananas.
It's a fantastic base to start from.
I mean, you know, it's like the certain liberal delusions about Fox News, which is that Fox News is the most powerful name. It runs everything, and maybe Republicans think this too. But on a good night, 3 million people are watching Fox. And that's 1% of the population of the country. And it is 4 or 5% of the overall electorate. I mean, that's not a good base. You know, I mean, it's not nothing, you know, but it's something. And you probably shouldn't be crosswise of it because it has an amplifier, a megaphone effect. But, you know, this is the thing that Biden did in 2019. Came into the race in a very strong position. And he had a theory of the race, which is I'm going to be the non-crazy person that doesn't, like, you know, kowtow to the left. And they kept the pressure on him to abandon that strategy was daily. And it was hit and he was hit and he was hit and he was hit. And the poll numbers never changed. I mean, he was ahead by 10 points in April of 2019. And he, you know, after the craziness of the first two states, he just sailed into the nomination. And he did so by ignoring the echo chamber.
And, you know,
and here's DeSantis, and he is living inside the conservative echo chamber.
But not only that, when Biden was ignoring the liberal echo chamber, he didn't have a job. DeSantis is implementing, he's translating the echo chamber into policy in Florida in hopes of saying, look, I'm putting up these huge wins, these big conservative wins for you while Trump is talking, and while you're talking, and while this this is the record I'm establishing about the things that you guys are talking about here.
Right. And you know, what is it, Mark, you say? How did he pull this off from 2018 to 2022, right? Winning by half a percentage point in 2018 and winning by 20 in 2022. How did he pull this off? How did the party move so far to the right? All of that. Well, it wasn't appealing. It wasn't making the libs cry, unless you think that the COVID liberal, you know, the approach on COVID was done to make liberals cry, which would be an insult to him. He made a bet. He did something very risky, and it paid off in spades. And he hasn't learned his own lesson, or is haunted by something, you know. And obviously he's in a very difficult position. Trump is the commanding leader. He's got to figure out how to navigate this. We're not doing that. We're just caviling on the sidelines. But I mean, there is so much there in those policy numbers, right? Economy, size of government, immigration, and even foreign policy. And he's not going there, except on the issue that is Democrats plus 10, right? He's... Abortion, Democrats plus 10. We have now this result in Wisconsin was like a pro-life state, the most powerful Democrat, Wisconsin Democrat for 30 years was David Obie. He was pro-life. Like, that's a Catholic state. You know, Catholics dominate Milwaukee. I don't understand what more you need to see to say, don't sign a 6-week bill if you want to survive.
Everyone who's been elected president in the modern era has run saying they're going to bring the country together. They didn't, maybe they didn't all mean it. They certainly didn't all execute it. But I've never seen a major presidential candidate who puts less emphasis on bringing the country together than Ron DeSantis. It's not even a hint of it.
So anyway, I think what we have here is a fascinating example of a policy atmosphere that seems to be favoring the rival party in very interesting ways that the rival party is taking almost no advantage of. And I don't know why.
I don't think that CNN poll really captured the reality, right? Because what are issues that are front and center related to, for instance, the coming fight over the budget and the debt ceiling? Republicans don't want to raise taxes on the wealthy. Democrats do. That's very popular. Republicans have been tagged with wanting to cut entitlement programs. They don't really want to, but they've been tagged with it. That favors the Democrats. Abortion favors the Democrats, as we've said. Some of these issues related to sexuality, some favor the Republicans, but some favor the Democrats. And all the issues that favor the Republicans favored the Republicans before the midterms. And that didn't make a big difference. So whether it's Trump or whether it's taxes and spending, I don't know. But I don't think it's right to say, based on that CNN poll or anything else, that the issue environment clearly favors the Republicans.
Right. Okay. I just want to go back to the Trump polling that I mentioned, the 25%, because here's what's interesting about it suggestively. It's not just that his number now is 25%. It was that on August 11th, August 11th, 2022, his favorable number was 35 and his unfavorable number was 58. This is, again, CNN polling. March 31st, before the indictment, it was 29. April 6th to 7th, it was 25. So we have a decline over time of 10 points in his favorability rating. The question is, what is it? What is it that happens? What do you have? Okay, hold on. Mark is holding up the general election, Trump versus Biden, and we have Trump plus 2. Is that it? Is that what you're showing me?
Trump 1.8.
I'm trying to read it.
Trump 1.8 in Real Clear Politics. 1.8
in the Real Clear Politics app.
Right. So, I mean, imagine how much he might be ahead if he could improve his favorable ratings by not running such a horrible campaign.
Fair enough. Okay. So everything is very confusing, is what I'm trying to say. Because what this seems to suggest is that while we keep saying that this indictment is good for him among Republicans, there is some evidence that is bad for him in the general population. And of course, we have two or three other indictments potentially coming. And that's Matt Continetti's point that, it's like Gulliver can survive one thread laid across his body as he lies on the ground by the Lilliputians. He can break through that. But if there are multiple threads, he can't get up, right? If they tie him down in multiple ways, he can't get up. So let's talk about that Trump number, Mark, because I've said this to you before, like you told me in November of 2015, I think it was, you said, I haven't seen anything like this. I was like, oh, it will fade. Ugh. And you were like, no, this is something very big is going on here. I've never quite seen anything like this. It's a whole new thing. And you were right. And you're sitting here saying, don't underestimate Trump, not only as a Republican, which you said last year, but in the general election. What is it that you, how do you define why he is in the position that he is in?
Because I feel compelled. Okay. Yeah. I feel compelled to say, because some of your listeners may not be familiar with my work, I'm not rooting for Trump. I'm simply analyzing what I see. So this is not boosting him or trying to create a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think he's in a very commanding position for the nomination. I think the other indictments, with the exception of the potential indictments, with the exception of the obstruction of justice one, I think will be very weak and only help him win the nomination. And then you look at the Electoral College, you know, is Biden going to beat Trump in Florida, Ohio, or Iowa? Doesn't appear that that's in the cards. So we're talking about 3 to 5
we're just
states.
Back to the same states.
Yeah, we're back to, you know, can Trump beat Biden in Georgia and Arizona? I think he can. If my box of cereal still costs $8, I paid $8 for a box of cereal this week. If Putin is on the march in Europe, again, these are hypotheticals, but they're not far-fetched. You know, Joe Biden, his favorite expression, don't compare me to the Almighty, compare me to the alternative. If Joe Biden says, make me your president for 4 more years till I'm 86, and he fumbles in the debates in a way that he's currently protected from, I mean, there's all sorts of scenarios where I think it's not far-fetched to say that Joe Biden and Donald Trump are the nominees and Trump beats him. So he has such a hold over tens of millions of people. And there are a lot of people now who will tell a pollster they don't approve of Donald Trump. But if they're general election voters and the choice is Trump or a guy who says, make me president till I'm 86 and let me continue to raise taxes and let me continue to be in charge of dealing with inflation. I'm not predicting Trump will win. I've said it before, I'm not rooting for Trump to win. But one-on-one, if he's the Republican nominee, and I expect he will be the Republican nominee at this point, he can win. And that doesn't mean he'll win easily. He didn't win easily the first time, but he can win. And to say otherwise, I think, as I said, he's currently ahead in the Real Clear Politics average. Now, you can quibble about that, but I haven't seen Biden ahead by more than a few points in any head-to-head. So given the way the Electoral College works, if the Republican nominee is close in a head-to-head, Republican nominee is going to win.
Ooh, see? Now, why explain that?
Well, no, just the like we know the
about the Electoral College, I mean.
The Republicans haven't won the popular vote very often lately. Bush won it, but other than that, they lose it. But they still are competitive in the Electoral College, and Trump won and Bush won the second time because the Electoral College currently, not systematically, but currently skews towards the Republicans. They can win more electoral votes than their popular vote share would suggest. And that'll be true in 2024, regardless of who the nominees are. You know, a lot of people vote in California and a lot of people vote in New York. That, by the way, infects the polls as well. If you're polling America, one in every seven participant should be a Californian, and that's going to skew the poll towards the Democrats in a way that doesn't help you understand the Electoral College. And Trump's people understand this. One of the underrated factors, both in terms of his winning the nomination, the general, he has the most professional operation he's had in his three runs. And they are thinking about the general election now, which is not the way, you know, you would think a chaotic, shambolic operation would be going. They're doing what smart campaigns do, much more than Trump did in 16, even, which is think about how to simultaneously message for the general election while winning the nomination. And that will give him a better chance.
But okay, so can I play?
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I just want to ask, in what ways is he successfully messaging for the general? Maybe it's my inability to hear it at this point from him, but I don't hear it.
Do you watch the policy videos they put out like almost every week? You watch any of them?
I see.
I mean, so crime, all the issues that John cited earlier, crime, immigration, inflation, toughness around the world. All of those, if you took Trump's name out of the equation, which obviously is not realistic entirely, but suburban voters in suburban Milwaukee, suburban Philadelphia, they don't like Biden's record and the Democrats' record on crime, immigration, or inflation. So that's how. And although, you know, if he gives a 90-minute speech and talks for 5 minutes about, you know, stolen election, that's what the press will cover, and not it's right to point out that he's still lying about the 2020 election. But he's talking a lot and communicating a lot on crime, immigration, and inflation in a way that is a general election message. It appeals to the party too, but
right. So there are all kinds of weird data points that should be local that have become national, right? So on crime, for example, Trump has no chance of winning California. But when Whole Foods closes a supermarket in the city of San Francisco that it just opened a year ago because it is unsustainable because of the crime outside and the shoplifting, that is an issue that can play in Wisconsin and Georgia in a way that, say, 20 years ago, it never would.
100%. Look, Republicans can say the president, or Democrats can say the president of the United States has no role in what's going on in the streets of San Francisco. But the reality is, you can be a partisan Democrat if you're honest and say that Republicans may not have better ideas, but the Democrats' ideas have been tried, have had to govern our urban areas, and they failed for decades. And Trump is the master of that, and the press can ignore it all they want. But that's a big part of why he got elected in 2016. Right. People understand why that Whole Foods closed. They understand it.
Yeah. Let me just play devil's advocate though, because you're saying, you know, Republicans have this strength in the Electoral College that they don't necessarily have in the popular vote. But in these states that matter, Georgia, Arizona, Wisconsin, being the three ones that decided the election in 2020, Herschel Walker lost by 8, I think. I have that number right? In Arizona in 2022, obviously, Carrie Lake lost by 5, and
Blake Masters.
I was going to say Peter Thiel guy. Blake Masters lost by a comparable margin or a little larger. And then, of course, in Wisconsin, we saw the results on last week with Protasiewicz, you know, winning by 11 points over Kelly in the Supreme Court race involving largely centering on abortion. So the electoral results that we've seen, granted in off-year cycles and all of that.
But there's another big difference.
Go ahead. Okay.
Presidential races depend far less on money than down ballot races, far less. It's one of the big mistakes I think people make in analyzing the difference in these things. Every one of those Democrats raised way more than the Republicans. Every one of them did.
Right.
And Trump may or may not raise less than if he's the nominee than Biden, but it doesn't matter nearly as much.
Fair enough. Although you do then have the possibility, a weird reverse possibility, which may be the story in Arizona in 2020, which is that the down ballot candidates drag Trump down a little bit.
They could. But do you, like look at Herschel Walker, horrible candidate. But do you know how badly he was outspent by Warnock? It was like, it was like 5-1 or something. I mean, I don't know what the numbers were, but it was massive. Yeah. Massive.
Yeah.
That makes a big difference in a Senate race.
I mean, I also think in a general sense that for a bunch of complicated reasons, Trump can be counted on to do better than his sort of deputized imitators.
Oh, right. Of course.
Yeah.
By definition. I mean, the electorate will be 40% larger in the, you know, in the presidential year. And how many, and if 88,000 votes are actually what decide the election, it was 88,000 in 2016. It was 45,000 in 2020. I mean, that's where the rubber really meets the road here, is whether or not we're just going to be back in one of these nail biting situations in which somebody, Biden didn't secure an inside straight because he won the popular vote by 7 million, but Trump won an inside straight in 2016 by losing the popular vote and winning in those three states. And of course he could do it again. I mean, that's the whole point, you know. Even in the blowout election, the only blowout election we've had in the last 20 years or 25 years, almost 30 years, right, which was Obama in 2008, there was a moment in early September when, could McCain have won? Sure. I mean, McCain, they, after the Republican convention and the sensational debut of Sarah Palin, which everybody now forgets because she's so evil and everything, but she was this electrifying moment. And had the meltdown not happened, had the financial meltdown happened 6 months later or something like that, could McCain have won? Sure he could have. I mean, you know, he ended up losing by 8, but anyone can win, right? I mean, I don't think Bob Dole could have won. That's the point. 96 was the last election, aside from 2008, where you had a thing where it was pretty clear, even, you know, in like May, that, you know, this was not going anywhere good if you
Well, even he was that. Going through the motions at the end. Like the last 48 hours of that campaign were just sort of difficult to watch.
So, right. Which is why, of course, the Democratic behavior in the recklessness of the Democratic celebration, or even the Bragg indictment or whatever, is so foolish, penny wise and pound foolish, because, you know, keep focused. You strengthen Trump at your peril. Like, don't be strengthening Trump in the Republican. Why do you think that's good? Now, I understand why. But this fact that there are two people are likely to be running in 2024, and one of them will be 81 and a half and is not in the prime of his focus, and the other is powered by some kind of demonic force inside him that allows him to rise to these occasions and show an enormous amount of energy and spirit. And, you know, just, it's very unnerving. Like,
and the first guy can't hold press conferences or do like substantive interviews. So
this how is many- the fact that Karine, how about the fact that Karine Jean-Pierre yesterday complained that people asked Biden too many questions?
So this was important.
Go ahead.
So she says she's being, you know, correctly, finally, the press doing a little iota of its job and saying, why won't he sit down and talk to us? Why won't he give actual interviews? Why won't he answer direct questions? She's like, he has gotten more questions shouted at him than anyone. And you're like, that is not an answer to the question. He is the least available modern president that we've ever had in terms of his press availability, in terms of responding to the American American publics need to know on very important matters. You know, it's the base. We've talked about it. It's the basement strategy as president, and it will harm him in election. When you put that guy up on a stage for too long, he either, if he's coherent, he's rambly and he's just making stuff up, you know, which then poor Glenn Kessler of the Washington Post has to pretzel himself into acrobatics to try to explain is really not a lie when it clearly is one, or he just doesn't make sense. I mean, when you stick a microphone,
You just got a preview of Christine's May media commentary column there.
It's a spanking of Glenn Kessler, ladies and gentlemen.
Four Pinocchios for Glenn Kessler of the Washington Post. Mark,
I recommend change the scale. Go to 5 Pinocchios. Four is random.
It's like turning it up to 11. Yes.
Just to get to this, Mark, you were Washington bureau chief of ABC News in the 2000s.
I was.
You were. I'm sorry. You weren't. You were political director? What was your title?
I was political director.
Sorry, you're political director. And so there was a whole thing then, constant, how many press conferences Bush having, and will he take questions? And it's been 62 days since there's an interview, and all this thing went on and on and on. And then there was Trump. Trump becomes president, and he doesn't shut his mouth ever. And if he's not going to the podium, or if he's not being interviewed, whatever, he is on Twitter, and he creates an entire world of, I am just going to talk every day, and everybody who was like, this is so terrible, the presidency is stage managed, and all this, is horrified by the fact that the president of the United States is letting you look into his brain on an hourly basis. And now we're back to Biden being the presidency, being one of these managed presidencies. And only now, right? Two years and a few months in, are people saying, he won't answer anything. Like, when somebody was answering because they didn't like the answers, they were horrified. You know,
I write all the time about how history is going to record the way they managed his time to minimize the chances that his decline will be revealed. And I just can't believe the passivity of the White House press corps, as you pointed out, Christine. Occasionally they ask about it at the briefing. But this is one of the biggest stories in, I think, presidential history, truly. He is managed so he gets sufficient rest so that he can have perfectly good moments sometimes. But it's staggering. It's staggering how unavailable he is. Now, of course, he made tons of mistakes before his decline, and that could be reason enough to try to keep him away from answering questions. But if they continue as they have to limit his availability, and if there are debates, and they may luck out and Trump may say, I'm not going to debate with the presidential commission. And the Biden people use that to say there'll be no debates. But if there are debates and he makes a single mistake, now they'll get him a ton of rest and prepare him and all that. But that could be decisive. And there's a reason why it's not a coincidence that he is the least available by far and the most vacationing.
Yeah, so the vacation also, the lack of transparency is what gets me, because when he goes to his beach house in Delaware, there aren't logs kept of who visits him. And he spends a good proportion of every week hanging out in that beach house. So the American people, again, I'm just trying to think, if this were a Republican president who didn't keep logs and was there half the time, there would certainly be outrage. The other thing about the White House press corps, they always take shut up for an answer. So when the press secretary says, stop asking me that question, they're like, oh, okie dokie. And then they go back to their usual business. That doesn't happen when it's a Republican press secretary, a Republican president.
Can you imagine a Republican president having a report issued saying one of the most significant failures of my administration was actually the fault of my predecessor, and I'm going to Camp David and not answering a single question about it?
And then saying, okay, exactly.
It would have shut the press corps down for 5 days. And they'd still be saying,
by the way,
demanding, make the president answer.
I think what's interesting about Biden, though, and then we can end with this, or your response to it, is we actually said some of the same things in 2020 about the debates, that Trump would eat him alive because he had been so relatively feeble in the Democratic debates. The guy who could never shut up for 30 years was suddenly answering. He had, you know, a minute and a half to speak, and he would finish his answer in 30 seconds and stuff like that. So uncharacteristic of the most logorrheic politician in America, you know, for the previous 40, 45 years. But he rises. He also does rise to occasions. Like when he was in that debate with Trump, he was focused and he did what he had to do, which is at one point he said, "Will you shut up, man?" And that was when the Trump people were like, "Oh, how dare he speak that way to the president?" It was exactly what he needed to do. And he did it and he pulled it off, and he pulls off the big moments. Like he pulls off the State of the Union. He pulls off when he does a press conference. He does not look doddering, despite the fact that everybody wants him to look doddering. He doesn't do them very often. He did the one, and the only one I remember where there was a sort of an issue was where he got into a tussle with Caitlin Collins at the NATO summit. But getting into a tussle with a reporter is not a bad look for a president necessarily. Yeah. And so he does have a record. And again, he's getting older every day, as we all are. But of course, that seems to be more of an issue for him than it is for some of us.
Absolutely rises to the occasion. And in Karen Dunn, Anita Dunn, no relation, and Ron Klain, he has three of the best preppers in modern American history in either party. They're very skillful at debate prep and press conference prep and interview prep. Yeah. And he listens, and it really serves him well.
Yeah. But of course, we do have the central fact of 2024 versus 2020, which is that he did not have to campaign or could not really campaign in 2020 because of the virus. And I don't think you can do that in 2024. He's going to have to, I guess, maybe not. I don't know. I mean, he'll have to go and, okay, does he go and give rally speeches at Stadia? How
every
does
so
he
often.
Not?
Every so
He's
often.
He's going to have to do it twice a month or something like that, maybe. And if they can get him on stage and he walks around and he says some fun stuff, and then they get him off stage fast enough and he does what he has to do, he maybe can neutralize Trump's advantage. But if he can't do that, you know,
if he doesn't decline more, I think he can do it.
I want to ask one question before we end. Mark, last time you were on, I think you were saying you were not that convinced that Biden was going to run again, period. Where are you now? Hasn't announced. He told Al Roker he's going to announce. He's announced that he's going to announce, sort of.
I continue to believe he will not be the Democratic nominee in my gut. In my head, he'll be the nominee. They're meticulous planning going on to prepare for his campaign. He continues to believe that if he doesn't run, the party's at risk of losing to Trump, and that he's the one who can beat Trump. And he tells people all the time he's running. I have two very good sources who are convinced he's not going to run, who've known him for decades. And it doesn't make sense that he would run. He can't possibly be president when he's 6 years from now. He just can't be. Just doesn't make any sense. So why would you kill yourself to run for president, metaphorically kill yourself to run for president, to get the job and then not be able to complete the term? So my gut says he will not be the Democratic nominee. But again, wow, that's based largely on gut and these two sources who know him well. And they say he'll announce in the fall that he's not running.
So do we look at Kamala's trip to Louisville and her trip to Asia, Africa, and some other things as some version of them seeing whether she's ready for prime time?
No, let me try to speak precisely about this. You can look at those as her and her husband's strong belief that if Biden doesn't run, she's entitled to be the nominee, to have his endorsement, to have the support of the DNC. And you can look at that as Joe Biden, who was extremely disrespected as the vice president of the United States by Team Obama, and sometimes by Barack Obama himself, who, of course, refused to back Joe Biden in 2016, as Joe Biden continuing to support the project he greenlit in 2020, which is everything must be in service of getting her ready to be president. She's met with all these heads of state. She gets all these high-profile assignments. They really elevate her role within the administration. But the people around Joe Biden think she could not win the presidency. Most of them don't think she could win the nomination. And so this is no longer an effort to get her ready. I believe this is an effort to respect her and to not have a fight with her. But they do not want her to be the nominee because they think she'd lose the general election.
There was that moment where I stopped hearing Biden and his people talk about the Biden-Harris administration. It was after about a year in. That disappeared.
Yeah.
They remember why they picked her, but they still regret it. And they still wonder why they didn't listen to the many people, including people from California, who said, don't pick her.
Yeah. Gretchen Whitmer. That's all I have to say. I don't know. Okay, you're shaking your head. Mark's shaking his head, so we're not going to go there. I've long since learned to heed the shaken head of Mark Halperin. So, thank you so much again, Mark Halperin, halperin.substack.com, to subscribe to Mark's essential newsletter, Wide World of News. We'll have you on again. And for Abe, Christine, and the absent Matt, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.